You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, Alex.
Hi, Nick.
Hey, man. So, do you want to talk about anything?
Like?
It just seems like there might be something you'd want to talk about.
I've got nothing.
You've got nothing?
The last few weeks have been pretty good for me. You know, I've done a lot of things with my time.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of positive things with my time.
Positive things with my wife's time. You don't have anything to say about that, about the fact that you recorded a cold open with my wife in California and took her out to dinner.
You weren't supposed to find out about that.
How was I not supposed to find out about that when this is a podcast that we share? And
I didn't know you actually listened to the podcast. I thought we'd record it.
And you think that I don't listen to
you just turn it in and you'd be, you know, you're so busy these days that you just kind of
We could sneak one through on you,
but
why would you sneak one through? Why would you want to get caught?
I am a big fan of your wife.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I like what she does.
Mm-hmm.
I like
choose
who
these
she,
words
I,
so carefully.
I like who she is.
Yep.
And you are so far away from us.
I'm gonna fucking kill you.
Little justice. Fuck yeah.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Little Justice, mm-hmm. The Alex Mallow death knell. Mm-hmm. Nope. Don't hum, you son of a. Okay. You just sit there and think about what you did. It's been a crazy couple of weeks. We've had some fun, had some good town halls, had some good stuff, you know, happening. But now we're back to,
it has been crazy. So you approached me with this theme and I had no idea what it means. And if the word is in the title of the episode, which I assume it will be, people will be coming here saying, what is this that you're talking about?
Yeah, I almost want to elongate it to like the intertextuality, allodocious, like whatever movie. Do you mean like something crazy, something real crazy and long?
You could do that.
Yeah.
Alienate our entire listenership.
Listen, dude, if they don't feel alienated already. Do you remember when our cold opens used to land on like lynching jokes? Like it's terrible. This is all bad. The theme of today is intertextuality. That's what we want to talk about, intertextuality. And I will say, I think that it's a theme that I would suggest exploring more than once down the line. Because I feel as I researched this, I realized that so many movies have examples of this.
It seems so specific because the it's like almost scientific term. But it's so broad what it could apply to.
Very broad. Very broad.
Intertextual. It, you know, it's literature, right? Like that's words, that's text. So when you apply the concept to movies, it's interesting because then you're dealing with it's more concept than anything, right? The translation of concept from one thing to another.
Well, and it's so let's break it down. What is intertextuality? I wrote this down. By definition, is the overlapping of various art forms. Really, it's that point where two works of art overlap. In terms of film, it can be where a movie overlaps with another work of art, and that could be a film, that could be a work of literature, that could be a piece of art, any part of pop culture. It's the intersection of these things, and I think it's actually most easily recognizable in film. I think that we live in an age of references and quips and like little things that are like, ooh, that's, you know, it's funny because that person's referencing something else. I mean, I think the entire Marvel catalog is built off of intertextuality. And
it kind of has to be.
It does have to be. And the film itself is intertextuality because it's, you know, all of them are referencing comic books, right? So already there's a layer of these works are based upon and, you know, bringing the film medium and the comic book medium together. But then within that, like they're poking fun at the fact that they're owned by Disney and they're poking fun at the fact of, you know, of previous movies. So there's like a bunch of like really cool references that
this is where I had a little trouble coming up with my selection because intertextuality can exist just by nature in a sequel, in an adaptation, But it can also exist in, you know, in parody, in reference, in allusion, in quotation. You know, there's like literally because of what film is, there's no, I think every single movie probably has some element of intertextuality, right?
I do. I think so too. I think the best way to look at it is what are our favorite examples of,
right?
What are the times when it's been used super, super well?
So let me ask you, because I'm not super confident in my choice as the best intertextuality, but I also kind of am. How do you separate this term from like adaptation or sequel?
So I think an adaptation is exactly like you said, like it's an adaptation. I think that the first thing that comes to my mind is Jurassic Park, right? Which I haven't brought up as an example, but will bring up as an example at some point because it is truly my favorite movie of all time.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Jurassic. It's a close tie between Jurassic Park and Hook. Oh, wow. But Jurassic Park takes the cake every time.
Learn something new every day.
Look at that. But when you have Jurassic Park, which is an adaptation, right? There is intertextuality at play, the novel and the movie. But I wouldn't say that it's my favorite example of intertextuality, right? Because it is just taking a story and adapting it to a different medium.
Gotcha.
However, in Endgame. Right? Avengers Endgame, which literally goes back and references all the movies that it has made that have been made before previous to getting here. You know, I think that it was kind of this amazing thing because it was a celebration at that point. It was like, it was a victory lap. And it was also what I think was brilliant about the whole time travel storyline was that it allowed for, you know, fan service, intertextuality, but within a smart story context. There was a reason why they needed to go back in time. There was a reason why they needed to visit those moments, specifically those moments. And you bought it, and it didn't, to me, watching it, I was never distracted from the story with the intertextuality. I think that's what I look for is like, are there ways, whether you're referencing yourself or referencing other things, what are the ways in which movies do this that further the movie?
So that it's expansive because one of my previous selections for a film, Walk Hard, which exists as a parody, like that entire thing is every single scene, because it's based on it's referencing something else that exists. Every element of it, the cinematography, the plot, the script, the music, the everything, like that's an example too. I mean, there's so many options.
There are, you know what I push when I thought, cause I was thinking about the two, cause parody is all intertextuality.
Parody,
right?
It
literally is. But I was thinking about this. I think that when I think about parody, the reason that my mind, and not that parody couldn't be an example, you know, if you bring up a parody today, I think it'd be fine. But I think that why my mind didn't go there was because to me, parody is something where the intertextuality is the point. So you are actually stopping the story for intertextuality. You are literally saying, please look at this because this is referencing something else.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? As opposed to something that uses it. Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man, his whole performance is based off what pop culture references can I pull in that further plot, but also are perfect for my character.
Yeah.
And I think there is a strong difference in that. Not that one is better than the other, but I think that's why one is parody and one is your favorite example of intertextuality. And there's bad examples, not bad examples, but there's people who have used it that talking about fan service, because you really can't talk intertextuality in movies without talking about fan service. One of the things that I always think of is the Star Wars movies, the most recent Star Wars movies from Force Awakens on. And that's including Rogue One, and that's including Solo. I think that one thing that they had working against them is that right now Disney has cornered the market on nostalgia, and we go to these movies. Like I was breaking down, like one of the most fascinating things you should ever do: watch a video that breaks down the Force Awakens trailer. It is built to ramp up your nostalgia.
And I mean the films are built to do that.
Yes,
in their entirety. I mean, Force Awakens is basically just A New Hope, just bigger and louder.
But what's crazy is that's the thing. A New Hope, though, A New Hope is plot driven. Force Awakens is intertextuality driven.
It really is. Yeah. Well, that's what it feels like. I wouldn't say that I agree that Disney has cornered the market on nostalgia. I would say that Disney's business model is just built on nostalgia.
Yes, on nostalgia.
Right? It's these IPs, it's these brands where they're using the fact that people, and for some reason, it's our generation that grew up in like 70s, 80s, 90s, that now at this point in time, maybe just given the state of the world, everybody really loves to revisit their childhood in a way that I don't think our parents' generation does.
No, yeah.
And Star Wars and all these things, I think it's just a reflection of what people are asking for. And Disney just, they don't wield it very gracefully. They wield it, it's super obvious.
Yeah, it's super, I mean, there's something to be said for the 30-year cycle, right? Like, Back to the Future is my favorite example of this. It's every 30 years we want to go back. So like, Back to the Future was the 80s, but we literally went back to the 50s. And, you know, now we're in the 2020s, but in the 2010s, we were trying to go back to what? The 80s, when a lot of the stuff was popular. I think that is something that remains true. That nostalgia factor definitely remains true. But again, I go back to Star Wars and I say, like, yeah, you've built a movie that is specifically made to give us moments.
Yeah.
And that's when intertextuality fails, is when it's like, we're just, and I, you all know how much money I give to Disney parks annually. But like, I still do stand by that the movies, the best movies of the Star Wars films that came out recently were the ones that like really tried to, yeah, they gave you those moments, they gave you the fan service, but they also said, no, let me chart our own course. Like, again, not even a movie, but that's why The Mandalorian is so successful.
Right.
Because it says, yeah, we're going to be in the world that you recognize, but we're going to tell a story all our own.
Which is what I'm hoping is as they move forward with all their new TV shows. I know there's a Kenobi show coming out and stuff like that, that they look at things like The Mandalorian and realize that like the nostalgia gets people in the door, but it doesn't get them through the movie.
It does not get them through the movie. And you know, we did, I think I've sent it to you. We got our hands on the Colin Trevorrow script for the final Star Wars.
I haven't read. I mean, I'm so exhausted by the whole thing now. Like, I don't really even care.
It's so, but honestly,
you know, like Star Wars, I've lost a lot of love for Star Wars in the last 3-4 years.
It was so refreshing to see a movie that really was just its own story. And again, built upon, I think that was the thing, you know, breaking down Star Wars. I think that was so much of what happened was, you know, and this is nothing new at this point, Rian Johnson, it seemed, tried to take the trilogy in a very different direction. He literally did away with, he like built a story that did away with what The Force Awakens had established purposefully. And then it seemed like J.J. Abrams in the studio came in with Rise of the Skywalker or The Rise of Skywalker and was like, nope, let's erase all of that.
We'll just walk that back a little bit.
Walk that back.
Which is when it gets confusing. I mean, that you need a clear voice when you're referencing something. And I think like, intertextuality from something like book to book or a straight up book to movie or sequel or reboot, it's clear when you have one source material and you're trying to reinterpret it in a different way, but it's from a single source material. I think what's so bloated about Star Wars is just how many references they're trying to make from how many different things, and they're trying to read an audience that they don't understand. They think all it is nostalgia, and if you just carpet bomb everything about every movie and insert references and visuals, all the things, that people are going to eat it up. But like, that's not really how it works
at all. That's not how it works at all. You know, I think that it's the kind of thing that people, I hope that, especially given the state of the world right now, as we have this moment to pause and rethink things, I think that's one of the things that I hope gets just thought about with, you know, people who are making the decisions. Like, we actually can make good stories and still give the Easter eggs. We don't need to, you know, ham fist either one of those,
right?
You know, so I that's part of the reason I want to talk about this, because I was just like, you know, what are the stories that really were able to do that, were able to insert all the references that we ever want to hear?
Well, so do you think that it can exist without any references at all, or very few? Like, do you have to be so direct about it, or can something be so kind of hidden in its source?
I think it can be hella subtle. I don't think it needs to be over the top at all. I think there's several movies that have, you know, and so many, think about it. How many movies have built upon other movies? You know, Get Out is basically a Hitchcock lesson. You mean, right. Like,
well, that's the thing. Even if something is totally unique, it's not totally unique. And not just in film, but in anything, like, you get inspired by other things. Like, everything exists in everything else.
everything. I was thinking, you know, everything builds upon everything else. And I think that there's movies that do it more blatantly than others, but I think that's part of, that's the other reason why I think that this is kind of a cool topic to discuss, because it's just never ending. You can dig into this rabbit hole forever.
Yeah.
I mean, really, sit and tweet at us when you think about this at Little Justice Pod, Little Justice Pod on Twitter. And Lil Justice Pod on Instagram. Hit us up. Let us know what you think.
Tell
about
us about
this.
Your blossoming intertextuality.
Yeah, you know, how are you? Are you an intertextual?
I'm an intertextual.
Dude, I am a total intertextual. My scripts, every one of my scripts has been stolen from about 20 different writers. You know. So
oh,
yeah.
Oh, really? Man, you just write Tarantino's. If Tarantino was from Boston, that's you.
No, if Tarantino was from Boston and black and liked voodoo, that's me.
Tarantino basically is black.
He wishes. He severely wishes, but alas. But yeah, that's the, you know, crash course in intertextuality. So I'm very interested to know what you chose for this, because
yeah, you do want to start with me?
I would love to start with you.
Okay. When you're doing yours, I'm gonna grab my hamburger and eat it because I'm starving. But wow. I will begin. I will wow. begin. Well, I'm gonna wait, you know. I'll tell you when I'm back from getting my hamburger for you to start. I'm not going to just walk away.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. That's cool. That's
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick advertisement break to pay for things. But when we come back, we will have some money choices for you. We will be right back.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And we are back. We are back. We are back.
So again, like it's kind of a hard thing to pick out, right? Where to go with this, because you can go so many different ways. I wanted to go from literary source material, right? Something adapted from something a little deeper than just like an old movie being redone or an idea being reimagined. So I started looking at text. My initial choice, I realized I didn't really want to do it because it's not quite close enough. And that was Apocalypse Now, which is based on Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, but different time period. Like it's really just like the threadbare trajectory that's copied. And you can see Heart of Darkness in a lot of, if you saw Ad Astra that just came out last year with Brad Pitt, it's the same kind of thing, right? You kind of start in the light and you head deeper and deeper and deeper into the Heart of Darkness. And like that idea has been explored and explored. And obviously I love Apocalypse Now, but I didn't think that there was enough in terms of the relationship between the source material and the new product to give conversation. So what I did choose begins on black and you just hear a ting. 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 You hear some people murmuring, talking. It gets a little louder. The credits are rolling. You open on a vast field somewhere in the south. Ting. Ting.
Good there's for
a,
you.
There's a man on horseback, comes into frame, pan over a little more. It's a chain gang working on the railroad. Ting.
Oh, I love this movie so much. Yep.
Title card comes up.
I'm about to say, is there some music that plays?
Not yet. I don't think so. I think it's title
Candy,
card.
And then Big Rock Candy Mountain?
And then Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Okay.
And the title card is Oh, brother,
oh, brother, where art thou? Oh, brother, where art thou?
We take off through that bayou.
Wait a minute. Who elected you leader of this outfit?
Well, Pete, I figured it should be the one with the capacity for abstract thought. But if that ain't the consensus view, then hell, let's put her to a vote.
Suits me. I'm voting for yours truly.
Well, I'm voting for yours truly, too.
Okay. I'm with you, fellas.
Yeah, so it was an interesting way to open it, because I remembered it differently also. The opening is literally just the chain gang working.
Yeah.
You don't see our main characters. You don't see, there's no music. It's just this scene. And then it cuts the card. And then suddenly the music gets peppier and, you know, George Clooney and John Turturro and Tim Blake Nelson will pop up in the field and the story kind of starts. But I thought, as like a cold open to a movie, to just completely ignore it, it's just focused on the toil and the sweat and these guys singing. And the whole movie is about music and the whole movie is about story and mythology. And I thought it's an amazing way to open. But for those of you who haven't seen it, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is a Coen Brothers film starring George Clooney, Tim Blake Nelson, John Turturro, John Goodman's in it. Stephen Root. I love anything Stephen Root does. He's the stapler guy from Office Space. And as soon as you start to notice him, he's in everything, and he's also
a staple of Coen Brothers films.
Yes,
you know, he's in so many of them.
Correct, but it is the film is basically like a Southern Gothic retelling of the Odyssey.
Yep.
And it says right in the title cards, based on the Odyssey. But obviously, the Odyssey took place, you know, in ancient Greek times, has nothing to do with the South in the turn of the century. And in terms of intertextuality, it just seemed like they knew they wanted to do the Odyssey.
Yep.
And they created an entirely brand new thing around it that keeps all the elements, that references all the characters, that keeps the same emotional arc of what that story is and what these characters go through and what the end goal is, the pursuit, you know, the journey and the pursuit and all these things. But it creates its very own visual language, musical language, vocal language. Like, it is entirely wholly its own thing.
Who's a honcho around here?
I am. Who are you?
Well, sir, I'm Jordan Rivers, and these here are the Soggy Bottom Boys out of Cottonelia, Mississippi. Songs of salvation to salve the soul. We hear that you pay good money to sing into a can.
Well, that all depends. You boys do Negro songs?
Sir, we are Negroes.
It's just brilliant. It's brilliant.
They find some amazing, amazing ways to take these moments that happen in the Odyssey and translate them into Southern Gothic. Like the John Goodman as the Cyclops is that whole sequence.
Yeah.
What's his name? Big John T? Is that what they call him?
In
the
movie? Yeah.
The one thing you don't want is air in the conversation.
Once again, we find ourselves in agreement. What kind of work you do, Big Dan?
Sales, Mr. McGill, sales. And what do I sell? The truth, every blessed word of it, from Genesis on down to Revelations. That's right. The word of God, which, let me tell you, there is damn good money in during these times of woe and want.
Woo, he is so amazing. And
it's amazing. They like turn him into some, you know, money hungry swindler. You know, he's not a physical threat until he picks up his club and just wails on him.
But they shoot it from that up angle, that kind of Orson Welles up angle. So you just really get the size of this man. And and they're just, you know, and then the sirens is obviously just, and that's so, I mean,
and again, it's so obvious what they're doing in all of these things. Like, you know, going into the Odyssey, there's going to be a Cyclops, there's going to be the sirens, there's going to be all of these things. There's, you know, Poseidon, which is basically just the law enforcement who's pursuing Odysseus the whole time in the Odyssey, gets translated to running from the law, like, which is pretty brilliant. And it doesn't even need to be a character per se, even though there is like a lawman who catches up with them at the end. The way in which all of these elements are translated smoothly, where if you don't know the Odyssey, you wouldn't ever guess that this was coming from what it was coming from.
Yeah, no, it really does. The illusions are so, but then they also do things like, I think that, what's her name? What's his wife's name? Is it Penelope in the movie? Because, I mean, they do.
Ulysses
do
is literally the his name of the main is, character.
His name is Ulysses.
Penny.
And then she, Penny. So yeah, close to Penelope. Like they do these things that reference it. But the other thing I was going to say, and this is just a Coen Brothers staple. The other thing that makes it the intertextual is the music. The mm-hmm. music is, you know, they weave in these amazing bluegrass and folk songs. I mean, that soundtrack is one of the best soundtracks of the 2000s.
It's amazing.
The quality of the music is just so beautiful.
And it's wrapped into the plot, you know, it's wrapped into the identity of the film is this music.
Very much so.
And
very much,
you know, somehow folk music, you know, like down home folk music can correspond to, you know, mythological storytelling.
Well, and
you know, where the muses and everything told through, you know, told stories through song in the Odyssey. All these things happen. So to have the muses be there in the music, it takes one element and translates it in a totally unique way.
No, it's a really great, and I also love, I mean, you know, I think that the you know, the blind man coming in like on the train track cart. Mm-hmm. From the beginning, like sets up the prophecy of what's going to happen. Like there's so they take these elements that in any other filmmaker's hands would feel so grounded and real, and they make them.
And it would seem ridiculous. Like, oh, let's take the Odyssey and they to literally go from, okay, like, oh, there's an oracle at the beginning. Well, we'll make a character who's the oracle and we'll do the Cyclops and he'll wear a thing. Like it's so obvious and it never feels like they're trying too hard or they're shoehorning something in just to have it there. They took what made each element of the story works and they you know, massaged it into the fabric of a Southern Gothic story. And it's amazing. Yeah. And going through, I hadn't really gone through, you know, the Wikipedia or anything before I watched it, but every single character has something and corresponds to somebody. Stephen Root, who plays the blind radio station manager, who's the one who records them in the beginning, and sends their music out for everybody to listen to, right? And by the end of the movie, they're like famous, is supposed to be Homer.
Yep.
As the person who makes him known.
Makes him known.
Among everybody. Pappy in the movie is Zeus.
Pappy Daniel?
Corresponds to Zeus.
I love it.
Let's see. The sheriff is Poseidon. He's pursuing him the whole time. I mean, everybody has a place. Everybody is particular, but it never feels that way.
No.
You know, it never feels like it's too much.
And they get away with these non sequiturs where all of a sudden people just start, like I love in the scene right before the great flood at the end where the gravediggers just bust out into that beautiful song. It never feels. And I mean, and the movie, I think what's funny about this is the movie kind of sets up an intertextuality of itself because George Clooney talks about how the Coens had him do what he calls his trilogy of idiots or his idiot trilogy. And this was the first movie. So all the movies that came after this were all in their own way, kind of comments related to it.
Yeah.
Ulysses, like, cause he did this and then he did Intolerable Cruelty and then he did Burn After Reading and then they snuck Hail Caesar in there. And,
Snuck Hail Caesar, and I don't think anybody remembers.
Yeah, Hail I don't Caesar. Know if anybody, and it's so sad
people
because
remember Burn After Reading.
Yeah,
and they don't remember Hail Caesar.
And Burn After Reading was a hard watch, man. Not that it was bad.
Not great.
It was like it was just like
I think it was incredibly bad. It was
well, I like it. It was just like very dark. Like it was like too dark. It was like dark.
It was too meandering to be dark. It didn't take itself seriously enough.
I'm sorry. That
I don't know.
When I love Richard Jenkins and his spoiler alert, but his death was just heartbreaking to me. I was like, why the hell did he have to die? The man did nothing to
anything. It is one of those things where like, if it felt like they were really in control, if there was a reason for it, a method behind the madness, you know, a purpose to why the things were happening, it'd be different, but it didn't feel that way.
No, it did not feel that way at all. But yeah, so that's such a great pick, dude. And I think that's exactly right. It's the intersection of all these things and all of these things serve the story and make it fuller, make it just give it more depth, you know? Yeah. Oh, brother, where art thou? Nice choice, Alex. Nice choice.
All right, I'm going to go get a hamburger from
get your hamburger.
The bag and I will be
get
right
your hamburger. I'll entertain them while you're gone. So while Alex is getting his hamburger, I just want to say that anything that he has said to my wife, anything that he's done in my absence from California, I'm going to get him back for it. I'm going to make him pay. he is going to bleed for what he did by swindling my family into recording a cold open that I did not agree, that I did not oversee, that I did not sign off on. So you heard it here first. His ass is mine. 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 Oh, you're back. That's nice.
All right, I'm here.
I left a little present for you.
Of course you did.
In the little thing, so you probably want to let it sit. Let it sit. Don't edit it out. In fact, and keep your mic on too, because I could hear you singing in the background. It's very funny. It's very funny. Let it sit like a little gem for the audience.
All right. I will. I'll do that.
So you want to hear mine?
I do. I'm going to move my mic away.
Yeah,
I'll cut my audio out.
Because you're chewing. Yeah. So my movie is kind of a cheat, because so much of the reason that this movie has intertextuality is because of one element. But the element is the movie, and the movie is the element, and you cannot separate the two. So we open on a screen with some red flames against a red background. And then, like, and some kind of interesting, like, feels Middle Eastern music. Boom, ba, ba, boom, ba, boom. We see the title, and then we flash to a night unlike any other night. We hear a voice singing to us, telling us that he comes from a land, from a faraway place, where the caravan camels roam, where it's flat and immense.
I thought, I was like, it can't be that.
And the heat is intense. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home. What is it, Alex?
Okay. Aladdin.
Aladdin, baby. Arabian night, like Arabian days.
Wait, don't go. I can see that you're only interested in the exceptionally rare. I think then you would be most rewarded to consider this. Do not be fooled by his commonplace appearance. Like so many things, it is not what is outside, but what is inside that counts. This is no ordinary lamp. It once changed the course of a young man's life. A young man who liked this lamp was more than what he seemed. A diamond in the rough.
I was not expecting, as we're talking about Disney.
Yep, I know. It's so interesting to watch this movie in retrospect. Because this was at the height of the Renaissance. They had just had Beauty and the Beast. They had just had Little Mermaid. And this had been a passion project for a minute, right? They wanted to do this for a minute. And they come out with this movie. And it's right after we lose Howard Ashman. His amazing, amazing, you know, words and all the kind of incredible stuff that he did for them. So who's going to carry the torch of this movie? This was also a time when celebrities weren't doing cartoons, right? Right now, we live in this age where, like, every cartoon that comes out, it's like Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Depp and everyone is on these movies. But we forget that, like, first of all, voice work is, like, a very hard, very hard craft. It's not just regular acting. It's a completely different thing. And you had the central to this story of Aladdin was this character who, you know, they didn't know what he was. They knew that he was a genie. And the only person that they wanted to get was Robin Williams. To the point where, and this story is now legend, they actually he was like not about to do it, but to show him what it would look like and that they could do it. They were like, hey, we're going to give you free reign. Like, this is going to be your playground. This movie is going to be a vehicle for you to just be Robin and do your thing and be amazing. To show him what they wanted to do, they famously now took a bit of his stand-up and animated Genie to his stand-up. So they took that audio and, like, put an animation, and it's pretty amazing. And
I've never seen that. Does that exist out there?
Yeah, you can watch it. It's on, if you watch the Imagineering story, it's definitely on, or the Walt Disney Studios documentary on Disney Plus, it's definitely on there, but it's also on YouTube. But it goes through and it just shows you how married Robin Williams is to the genie and they're one of the same person.
And then, so when James Iglehart came along and did it in the new Disney movie.
Yeah, when he did it, it was... Didn't work as well, you know, but I mean, and James and Broadway, I will say, for all the shit I give James, James as the genie on Broadway was incredible, and was something that I got to see. And there's really nothing. I mean, there's nothing you can say. I mean, he made it his own, and that's what you kind of have to do, because you're not going to out Robin. Do you know what I mean? So the Broadway genie is a very different animal than.
Now there was also I don't want to get too far off on it. There was also another Robin Williams thing with Aladdin, where they screwed him over a little bit, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They did. Basically their whole thing was if I'm not quoting the story correctly, somebody correct me in the tweets, that his one thing was that he didn't want to have his name used for marketing. I feel like that was the thing, and
made into toys and things,
all that stuff. Yeah. And that was the first thing they did. And that
imagine really, trying to tell Disney that you don't want them to market,
to sell toys on on your name, and they did that, and then it caused a rift, and that's why he didn't come back for the second one, and then he came back for the third one, which was a welcome return, but like he really,
no
I don't
shit,
think
he did,
yeah, he oh yeah, he was in the third one, dude, he was right back, really? But I don't think people realize the impact that his performance had. Not just on our childhoods, because obviously when we heard it, when his death happened, that was like one of the greatest pains to so many of us. Like, you know, it was like losing a family member. I mean, so many of us grew up with him, and mm-hmm. and myself included. I remember when he died, I was at Disney World, and I actually got a call from you, Alex, and you were like, "Hey, have you checked the news?" And I was like, "No." And he's like, "Don't check the news until you get back." And that was that my engagement? Was that was it, right? That was, I think me and Sarah had just gotten engaged.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was around there. I don't know if it was like on the exact same.
It wasn't. No, it was. It was on the trip. It was certainly on that trip.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember that, dude. And yeah, it was. That was a tough one, dude. And but like, I think going back to the point, the impact that he had on voice work on celebrities in animated pieces cannot be understated. I mean, he really changed the game, and so much of how he did that was intertextuality. His genie is literally his stand-up, which is just a mile a minute of references.
Whoa! Whoa! Does it feel good to be out of there? I'm telling you, nice to be back, ladies and gentlemen. Hi, where are you from? What's your name?
I must have hit my head harder than I thought.
Do you smoke? Mind if I do? Oh, sorry, Cheetah. I hope I didn't singe the fur. Yo, Rugman, haven't seen you in a few millennia. Give me some tassel. Yeah, yo, yo. Say, you're a lot smaller than my last master. Either that or I'm getting bigger. Look at me from the side. Do I look different to you?
Wait a minute. I'm your master?
That's right. He can be taught. What would you wish of me?
Be ever impressive.
The one contained. But never duplicate genie of the lamp. Right here, direct from the lamp. Right here for your very much wish fulfillment. Thank you.
The cave scene, the Cave of Wonder scene alone.
Oh my God, like, the amount of stuff. And the stuff you don't understand as a kid, like you got to go back now.
It's
just
ridiculous.
To get half the jokes. Yeah.
He wanted to do the one that got cut. He wanted to do a George Bush reference. And they cut that. They're like, no, 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 you can't do that. You can't do that. But like, he got so many in. And by the end of it, I think somebody counted. By the end of it, you have to understand he's done 60 characters within one character. And it's insane. And I think one of the things that I really love about his use of intertextuality is like, there's such a, you know, that's why I say voice acting is not easy, because in his voice, it is all he found a way to do all these characters, but always keep it the genie. It's always him. It's always the genie doing an impression of, as opposed to a completely, threading that needle, which was so insane.
So you find the intertextuality mainly in Robin Williams and the genie.
It starts with him.
It's also based on, you know,
it's
a very old
based on a very old story, a lot of Disney within Disney references in there, but so many of those spur from Robin Williams, like he talking crab, like, you know, he throws out these things that are just so ridiculous. I mean, and here's the other thing I will say: I think that one of the things that Howard Ashman and Alan Menken's presence did in the Disney movie was really bring it back to a musical theater route. And you see things, you know, prior to their involvement, prior to Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid, you see these movies were kind of floundering. Nobody wanted to watch them. And when they came on with this kind of Disney Renaissance, one of the first things they did was instill a musical structure into these movies and say, okay, cool. So there's that I Want song where our hero is sitting and dreaming of a better world. So we got to have that. And there's all these different songs that we can include, you know, to really drive the point home of who these characters are. And if you've ever wanted, if you ever want to do yourself a favor, watch, you know, there's the Howard Ashman documentary on Disney Plus, which I definitely have to watch because I'm sure I'm going to cry. But I just love watching him talk about the thought behind music. And there's a scene where they have footage of him pitching on what would become Under the Sea. And the specificity with which he breaks down like why each instrument comes in at which moment, and understanding that every song has a drive, right? Songs are not, you know, the difference between musical theater and in a vaudeville show is that every song has a plot driven purpose, right? Under the Sea is a fun song, but it's Sebastian trying to convince Ariel to stay under the sea. And I think very much in that same vein, Robin's impressions, let's call them, all serve a purpose. Like they all are to illustrate points and to make, whether it's to make exposition more fun to swallow or to like drive home the stakes of like, hey, do not break this rule, or like, hey, tell her the truth. Do you mean like all these things are made that much more powerful and that much more palpable, right? I think about like how many animated voices do you remember, like you remember the genie? Do you mean I remember the genie? I'm talking to him right now. I can literally go back and be like, wow, I know, I hear it. I hear it in my head. And that means something. You know what I mean? So
do you think the platform of the story lends to that too? Like, is there anything about Aladdin as a concept, as a movie?
I think the one thing in the Guy Ritchie remake that I think Guy Ritchie did get right, because I've never directed a big budget Disney remake, so I don't know what the pressures are. I don't know what needles you have to thread. But the one thing I do think he understood innately was that the genie, that kind of character is an amplification of whatever charm the actor has playing it. And that's true for so many magical characters. Like I think back to, you know, Damn Yankees, with the Applegate, the devil, like it's, you know, whoever plays him gets to put their own spin on him because that's the whole point, right? He is, what he does is he is the catalyst. So as long as he's doing crazy things, you know, he can get away with being a lot of different things. And I think that that's always the fun of it. So yes, I think the Aladdin story, anytime you have a wish fulfillment, anytime you have a Faustian story of any kind, right? And I take it back to even like Little Shop of Horrors, which is about a freaking plant. Do you know what I mean? Like Little Shop of Horrors, you know, you stick, it's the voice in there, you know, can be anything, but it's the fun of that. It's the fun of like, yeah.
It's interesting in relationship to theater, I think, that the concept of intertextuality with character and performance, because theater is this thing where a movie is set, right? Once a movie's made, you can remake a movie with someone else in the role, but like that's kind of a one-off thing. Theater gets recast all the time.
Yep.
Right? So the character becomes, you have what the character is expected for the character to be based on the original cast member who played him and early iterations. And then there's also an expectation that there's going to be something slightly new. I'm sure you're like very aware of this, having stepped into so many characters that have been played before very differently than how you played them.
Yep. Yep.
So that's interesting. The one that jumps to mind most for me is Jean Valjean and Javert. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, where you have literally like you're talking about a voice, right? A recognizable voice. Somehow, based on the music, you know the depth of those voices before it's even cast. It could be anybody and it's going to have that same, you can hear it, which I think is so interesting.
No, it's the truth. It's, you know, anytime that you have somebody new step into a role, they're going to bring their own spin to it. They're going to do their own thing. I just think that with Robin as the genie, it was just the, it's, you know, it's everybody, like, it's watching all these guys put their mark on the Joker. Do you know what I mean? It's any, you know, so many, everybody's going to bring their own thing to it. But Robin brought just such a knowledge of pop culture and such a knowledge of himself as a performer. And it really made the movie something. And such a, and quite frankly, such a, he's heartwarming. Robin knows completely. He knows how to pull your heartstrings, man.
I mean, we've gone into Robin Williams before. We talked about just the pure efficacy of his warmth.
Yeah, it really is something to behold. So, yeah, man, Aladdin is
I like that.
I'm free. I'm free. Quick. Wish for something outrageous. Say, I want the Nile. Wish for the Nile. Try that.
I wish for the Nile.
No way! Oh, that feels good! Oh, I'm free! I'm free at last! I'm hitting the road. I'm off to see the world. I'm...
Genie, I'm gonna miss you.
Me too, Al. No matter what anybody says, you'll always be a prince to me.
Yeah.
Definitely one of my favorites.
I think this is something we're going to have to explore again. Maybe with a theme on top of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so too, because it really, you can go so many ways with this. So many ways.
So many ways.
You know?
Yeah. I want to watch Aladdin. I haven't seen it in so long.
Oh, dude. It was like my best choice last night. I was like,
so
yeah.
Do you recommend the Guy Ritchie one?
You know what? Here's what I'm going to say to you. There's things about it that I love. And I think that Will Smith, I think he did the best that he could. Like, it's such a tall order when you have a character that's like that iconic to essentially reinvent the character. And I think he did that. I think the only thing you can do with it is just have fun and do your thing. And I think that Guy Ritchie's strength was that he was like, Will, do your thing. So like, so much of it is reconfigured to like Will Smith. And like, I will say, I loved, like, there's actually a lot of intertextuality in his genie, because
he's aware of what he's doing in the shoes that he's stepping into.
He's aware, but it's not even like yes, there's some references to Robin, but there's also like just references to like his hip hop career and like black culture that are like really fun and like subtle, like things that you don't even necessarily like get on first glance. I think for me, the movie in general falls into the same category that a lot of these Disney remakes fall into, which is like, yeah, that's great that you did that. But like, what did you...
Well, the intertextuality is it feels milked.
Yeah, it's just
it feels like a cash cow.
Yeah, congratulations on doing a generation transforming film 20 years ago. Is this like... I feel like when I watch them, like, are we... Is this like a party where we celebrate that film? Like, are we just like... Is this like a little like, oh yeah, we made that thing party? a billion dollar party to celebrate the fact that we did something.
And it's interesting to watch the variety of quality too, especially like Jon Favreau's done a couple of them. And I thought The Jungle Book was amazing.
Oh my God. It was so good.
Yeah. But because it was different, because the concept was unproven. So they gave him a little more free reign to build the story out himself. It wasn't the animated Jungle Book over again. There was a lot of similarities, but it wasn't the same. And then it came time to do Lion King, and it was like, cool, the technology works. So now you have to do the Lion King verbatim.
And it was that
and technology. And that's what it was. Everyone's like, this is weird.
I also wonder if he got a little screwed because he was doing The Mandalorian at the same time. I can't imagine what the lift on Mandalorian was. Yeah, I think that if you're going to take the time and put the money in to make these movies, add something. I think the best parts of the new Aladdin are when they added something.
Yeah.
Something different. So yeah. Cool. Yeah, man.
Love it. Good choices. Fun topic.
Let
us know. Tweet at us, Instagram us, Little Justice Pod, LiljusticePod. I'm doing your job for you. You know,
no, do it. Please do it.
Yeah, come at us and smash that subscribe. How does this work? Smash that subscribe button.
Is that what we say? Yeah, you smash know? The like or
likes in the comments.
Likes in the comments.
Smash,
I don't know.
Smash. I don't know.
Smash. 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 Smash.
Smash.
Smash. Smash. Smash. Smash. Smash. Smash. All right, y'all. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye, everybody.
Little justice. Little justice.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.